Welcome to Finding Success Podcast. I'm Antti Pietilä, and in this episode, we'll explore how to build a 100 million sales pipeline with Virta Global's Director of Digital Sales and Marketing, Samuli Ahola. Welcome to the show, Samuli.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So, Samuli, Virta is a EV charging platform company, basically, software company mostly. But also hardware. You supply also hardware.
Yes, that is correct. So basically, by DNA, we are a platform company, and we provide software which helps helps you to control your business when you are running EV charging business or offering that as a service to your own customers or visitors or clients. And at the moment, we also work as a one-stop shop, meaning that you can also get the hardware and the software from the same place, because for the customer, that is usually the easier way. But by DNA, software and platform company.
And in this episode, we'll uncover this your journey from, let's say, 600,000 sales pipeline to 100 million sales pipeline. But let's first dig into what is Virta's business? Where are you? You are actually, like a URL says, Virta Global.
Yeah. Especially in Finland, a lot of people think that Virta is operating on a smaller geographical area than what we actually are. So at the moment, we have offices in Helsinki, Stockholm, London, Berlin, Singapore, and Paris. So most of our clients are from the European Union area, but we also have some business going on in Asia as well as we speak. And by DNA, what we actually do, let's put it this way, that if you are a company that is either interested in making EV charging actually a future revenue stream, or you have clients or visitors that you are actually parking to your locations, you want to offer them EV charging as a service to, make your customers happier, they are actually requesting it, or maybe they stay longer in your premises or in your retail stores when you actually are able to offer this, but you're not going to build your own team in the company that would actually, work 24/7 around EV charging, then we basically step in that, hey, we can actually help you, you don't need to worry about this, you focus on your core business and we run this whole. That may seem simple, service or business stream that when you think about EV charging, but actually there's a lot of complicated factors included in it.
And some special points, you need local representatives because you have to connect to the hardware side of it. You supply the hardware side as well. So that's one thing. And the other thing is you're basically targeting four different segments.
Yeah, you could say so, or maybe think about
buyer profiles.
Yeah, profiles, and that's also something that what we see in a young industry like ours, certain verticals might not be there in 2022, but in 2024, they're all of a sudden one of the most important ones to us.
Yeah.
So that landscape changes constantly, and when we move forward, especially when it comes to sort of this like if you, for example, European-wide also legislation drives different verticals to start considering EV charging and how that is going to impact their own business. So legislation is also a strong force in Europe that actually sort of drives customers towards us, and we might see that in 2025, all of a sudden there is a new vertical that EV charging is incredibly relevant for them, even though it's not like that at the moment.
You have to educate the customers like let's say in any tech business, basically,
yes,
that you're kind of, they need to know how to run the EV,
yes,
let's say EV side business, side hustle. It's basically side hustle for them.
Yes, for the majority, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is correct. And also what is interesting is that not as much anymore, but if we go back a couple of years, if we think about like the way that people were, contacting us, usually they already had an idea of how and what they are going to do. Maybe they have even already bought some hardware, which was completely incompatible with their actual plans, what they were trying to achieve.
Yeah.
So a lot of times it's about those discussions are, they have a lot to do with educational stuff, but also that, especially in Finland, people also very often want to buy the cheapest available hardware and then start figuring out like, hey, actually, what is the actual goal that we're trying to achieve with this?
Yeah.
Now we have these Chinese boxes, our storage is full of them, but we never thought about that, you know, how are we actually going to operate them or make money with them, or is there something that we could do this in a way smarter way when we think about stuff like, you know, energy load management, dynamic load management, all kinds of things that actually have to do with the electrical grid. And at the end of the day, best result for them might have been that, you know, they would have actually been able to run a much larger stack or network of chargers if they had thought about the energy things beforehand, which, for example, our software enables them to do.
A good example is the local mall, Hertz, down the road. I don't know if it's your customer or not, probably not. I think it's Plugins customer having a mall where you have 4 kilowatt chargers is brain dead.
Yeah,
basically.
Yeah, that is exactly like you.
You have to be there something like 10 hours to charge your car.
Exactly. That's not probably gonna increase your customer happiness that much.
No, they're usually empty.
Yeah,
and yeah, all the other parking places are taken. So
yeah. Yeah, that's the case, and that's a brilliant example that if I don't know about their specific case, but just the way that you describe it is that, you know, some people or companies might jump into making purchase decisions with price and hardware first without thinking about the actual use case and what are we trying to achieve with this. Is this a business stream, or is this something that is actually going to increase customer loyalty, or is this something that if we do this in a non-smart way, it's actually going to work to the opposite direction.
And this is
your happiness hasn't clearly increased because of that.
And as an example, your business is similar to any other tech business, again, where customers buy services, probably services, before they actually buy a piece of software.
Yeah.
And those can be totally incompatible with what they are planning to actually,
exactly,
or what they end up buying. So marketing wise, you have to educate, but you also need to be a little bit tricky. How do you communicate with them as they have already made a wrong investment?
That is also true. And I think now we're talking about this trend that we see also when talking about product information in general, that the traditional way is that, you know, you talk about features and different technical subjects, and then some may actually make their purchase decision based on those. But then when you actually think about what are you trying to achieve, what is the value that this can provide to you, and turn it that way around, things start making much more sense. And I think this is also the, you know, a little bit of the dilemma of when we think about whether it's marketing or product information or even selling, there are some traditional ways of doing things that might not be the best way to help the customer nowadays.
But if we go to the situation how it was when you joined and where you are now, so first, you were at that time around what was the year?
I joined the company 2019.
2019, you were something like 5-6 million euro company at that moment, and you are now 100 million.
Yeah, I don't know what's our final revenue number from last year, but if everything goes according to plan, this year we're going to break 100 million.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit before we as a first question, what is the competitive landscape? I mean, what things are competing in the minds of a customer from their attention? So usually the most tricky part is to get their attention.
Yes.
In the first place, and the competition is not necessarily other EV charger platform providers, but some other things as well.
Right. Right. Yeah, I think overall, if we think about the classical example that most of the CRMs are not necessarily competing against other CRMs, they're competing against Excels.
Yeah.
And I think if we go back to 2019, it was still, back then it was a relevant question that is EV charging actually going to be something that's going to be happening? Is it something that, you know, that the transportation is actually going electric? At that point, that was a really the relevant question that the customers were debating about. Nowadays, when we look at it, it's not really a question anymore. Like earlier, I mentioned the legislation and how that already in Europe, especially, is really, really pushing strongly towards new regulations that, you know, we need to decrease the pollution numbers and traffic needs to be more electric. And there's also a requirement for infrastructure that needs to be built in the EU territory. So I think like back in that day, we were still sort of preachers about how the world is going to look like yeah. when we move forward. Nowadays, it's more about is this going to be a business stream or is this going to be an additional service that we offer to our customers? And I think that's mainly the question what we're facing nowadays, that even if you pick companies from the very same vertical, for some, it is definitely something that they actually see it as a business stream, as an opportunity that's going to be a part of their portfolio when moving forward, that this is actually going to be something that eventually we will make money out of this. Then there are, you know, companies that view it more as not as a necessary evil, but more as of something that we want to do this with a low cost because we don't expect this to be an actual business. It's just going to be an additional service for our clients that they are going to be a little bit happier, but we don't expect necessarily this to be profitable for our own perspective. And if you look at the competitive landscape, you have some providers out there that actually are willing to fund the whole operation as long as you give them a piece of land. And they're going to keep all the money as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, that the competitive landscape is it's transforming all the time. And we also are seeing a pretty strict price competition at the moment, because what we see at the moment is a lot of EV charging startups booming and coming up, all with a little bit of different angles. But a lot of them are actually playing pure gambling when it comes to if they actually are going to exist in 5 years or not.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of risk players out there at the moment. And recently we also saw one of the biggest EV companies or EV charging companies in the world, ChargePoint. And they had huge layoffs and I think they needed to let go like half of their C-level recently.
Yeah.
So even the biggest players are now actually seeing the situation that if there's been some gambling beforehand, now the actual real world is starting to kick in.
Yeah, and I can easily see that there's a ton of places where they have invested on the, let's say, first generation charges, which
right.
are just inadequate
yeah.
For,
yeah, exactly.
for those needs. So I really don't understand why they put those 11 or 22 kilowatt hour charges in shopping mall, for example, where you need many, many hours to actually charge it.
Exactly.
Just, again,
doesn't make sense. And from the customer's perspective, they'd be probably more than happy to pay a few euros to get just the faster charger there.
Yeah.
That would be no issue at all. But again, there are very different perspectives on how companies and people view EV charging nowadays, that even if you don't think about it from the business perspective, but you at least think about it from the client's perspective.
Yeah.
And that already changes it a little bit.
But again, sales-wise, at that 2019, you really didn't have a digital sales function or
digital? No. When I joined the company, I was sort of like the lone expert with the title of head of digital sales at the end of 2019. And then I was, well, basically, previously when I was working for the marketing agency at Advanced B2B I used to work for, I had been preaching to, I don't know, 20, 25 different companies for the past 3 years about how sales and marketing should be working together. And then when I joined Virta, I could see pretty clearly that there are good things being done on the marketing side of things. And for example, the ideology of what the website should be doing and how it could work as a lead generation engine. All those were in place, but these two different teams were not aligned or working together or working towards the same KPIs. That was pretty much the situation. And I still remember my first visit to visit our UK team back then. I think it was probably December 2019. And the first thing I did was that our geo director explained me how all his sales cases are in his Outlook.
Okay.
And we started going through that. Okay, good. You have sales cases in Outlook. Perhaps we should put this somewhere where others can see them as well.
Yeah.
So I think that was a pretty descriptive starting point.
That's quite useful. So you might be having CRM, but not necessarily everybody's using
right,
it.
Right.
And I think one of the key things is to establish the KPIs, the common metrics of what is a lead, what is a sales qualified lead, and so forth. And you can start measuring how many of we are getting. The best case is that you know how much they are costing and how much money you are making
right.
out of it, because that opens the door towards the possibility to get, let's say, rid of marketing budget
right.
and move to the where when we are making money out of it, we'll invest more.
Right, right. Yeah, and I think overall, if there would be a number one thing to mention that. In my mind, if you start building this type of function, what needs to be in place and what is the number one priority to make sure that it works, it is the overall process. It's clearly, you know, you can do very good things on the marketing and digital side of things, but if the process fails at some point with sales, no one can actually see the results.
Yeah.
And that was also, if we think about, go back to 2019, 2020, I started working there sort of like in between, trying to understand to my best knowledge like how this actually goes, like what is the actual process of things, how they move forward, and what does the sales process look like, and if we're starting to actually build this process with the digital sales and marketing, how the handover should be. And I think like the progression, how we went from there, was that then we started to establish common rules on how the leads are passed forward, what is the criteria for them, how are we working from there. And I spent a lot of time educating the existing sales team about how, you know, when you get this type of notification, this is what it means, please take this action and let's see what follows. And very soon after that, I noticed that when the salespeople had this 360 sales role, that they were, you know, doing everything from prospecting to handling existing customers, then the actual engagement with prospective leads, if the engagement even was there, it was one poorly written email at maximum. That was the engagement level. So then from there, half a year later, we started coming up with the idea that what if we were actually have a team that their full day job is to focus on the engagement part of these leads and then reach out to new clients, prospective clients that we identify as being relevant. And from there, at the end of 2020, we formed the sales development team to actually be this glue between the engagement part of the early stages of the sales process. And I think overall, that was absolute necessity in order to get things to the place where they are right now. Because it's understandable why, if your table is already full of stuff as a salesperson, existing customers are calling you, if you get this one lead, the one email is probably the maximum that you're going to send back to them. But then if we look at, I think it was Outreach's study that they published a couple of years ago, that on an average, it takes 7 interactions to actually engage someone.
Mm-hmm.
So then you can pretty much do the math that there's a lot that we could do in the process for the engagement part if we are now only sending one poorly written email compared to the situation that you actually have a team of people whose job is to engage.
Yeah, and if you think about salesperson who needs to do the whole process,
right.
It's really difficult to manage the whole process from cold calling
right.
To the closing. And in your case, the salespeople need to travel to the location perhaps.
Right.
So there's traveling also associated. So it's really difficult to manage your time.
Yeah, yeah.
And the balance of those different activities, so that you close deals and you create new leads in the beginning and so forth. So dividing it that so that you have a SDR team who is actually doing the beginning of the sales process stuff, and then you have the sales executives can concentrate on the sales process side of it.
Right, like the later part of the of the actual process. That is exactly how it
qualified
is.
Leads where you can actually survey their discover they what is the best solution for them and negotiate and survey this place where they want to put the charges and so forth, make offers and negotiate prices and so forth.
Exactly. And I guess, like, if you put it that way, one of the most important functions of the sales development team is to maximize and optimize the sales team to spend their time where it actually matters.
Yeah. You have done it for a couple of years now. Have you seen the SDR as a function that can be used as a, let's say, training for becoming a sales executive?
Yes, it definitely can. However, it's not going to happen by itself.
Yeah.
It's something that needs to be structured in the company, and then it very much depends on what are the next roles that the company can offer at that point. A leap from sales development role to an actual software sales executive or account executive role is quite of a leap, and not everyone is able to take that leap despite the fact that they could be one of the best performers in the SDR team. So I think if the company has an inside sales function, for example, that could be a very logical next step from the SDR role to move forward.
But again, a complex product like yours, training a new salesperson is not an easy job.
No.
Whereas something like SDR, where you don't need to that long a training, but you do a high volume, so you kind of learn the basics well, then it's a good step to move forward.
Right. Exactly. That's how it is. And then also, I think it's something that very much depends on how closely the sales developers actually work with the account executives, because they can learn tons already while working as an SDR if that connection is there.
What about feeding the funnel? I mean, in the beginning, you were probably doing quite much outreach.
Yeah, I think like overall, when we think about back in those days, we didn't really have a team that was doing the outreach. Or do you mean like the beginning of the sales development team?
I mean, the beginning of 2019.
Yeah, I think overall, if we think about that situation, I think it was salespeople in 360 role, no one having actual time for prospecting, no structured process around it, no metrics to follow if that is actually happening or not. And I think overall, it was probably way less structured process overall than what it is nowadays.
But the process of getting new leads were mostly outbound?
Or? Yeah, I think. And also through channel, we already back then operated with a lot of resellers.
I
think that was one of the things that we were doing. But also, there was outreach definitely happening as well. And obviously at that time, we didn't really have the motion going on in a way that we would have the funnel that feeds the salespeople the way it does nowadays.
If we move to, let's say, end of last year or early this year, where are your leads coming now? Are they coming with the marketing-driven operation, outbound?
Basically, I think company-wide split most. If I think about the most recent numbers, company-wide split is that 40% of the pipeline overall comes through digital channels nowadays, either digital marketing or SDRs. And if we look at the new, just purely new customers, then the split is something like 45-55 company-wide.
45 is coming through the
digital.
And the SDR is...
Yeah, they're allocated within the digital.
Yeah, but the SDR is mostly outbound operation.
very much depends on a geo. In some geos, we have the lucky situation that their daily task is already filled with inbound leads and taking the meetings that are actually relevant from there. But that's not the situation in all the geos.
But if you, what is the split between inbound and outbound?
If we think about purely new customers and inbound portion of that, if I'm going to go and say company-wide, 25-30% are purely inbound leads that convert to being actual pipeline later on, that would probably be the split. And then the SDR outbound work on top of that would result into the roughly 45% of the overall new customer.
Yeah, pipeline. And the rest is coming from through channels and...
Yeah, sales executives themselves, one way or the other.
Referrals, but
referrals kind of... and, you know, basic ground sales work.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Driving around the motorway and saving a slot there. And, I'll call that guy there.
Yeah.
So, the usual.
Yeah.
Let's say unstructured outbound. But that's, of course, something that's happening. Perhaps you have real estate investors. Mm. They buy charges to one location, then you sell to their other location. It might be a new customer for you, but there is a
connection. Anyway. Yeah.
Connection, same board members or same executives or whatever it might be. So if we focus on the inbound side, what are the ways for you to fill the channel? Paid ads, search, social?
I would say that from day one, since I joined the company and probably even before that, we have considered that our website it needs to be the number one trap, Katiska in Finnish.
Yeah.
That, you know, we have this one hub that whenever we get people to land there, that is actually where the magic happens. So we've been focusing a lot on creating content for organic traffic, thinking about these basic, you know, top of the funnel, middle of the funnel, bottom of the funnel type of things. And then after that, when we actually sort of got the machine working in English, then it was time to translate it, because we operate in different markets nowadays. We have at least language versions of English, German, French, Swedish, Finnish, at least those. So then sort of when we found the pattern that works, it was time to, as soon as we had the local sales team in there, then we wanted to obviously translate the best bits that work. And then from the promotion side of things, we have tried to build as much of an automated machine as possible when it comes to paid advertising. That whenever we have, without having to discuss with the salespeople, we want to ensure that whenever there is a sales case in the pipeline, certain advertising cadences automatically trigger then. And then the prospective client would see our best performing content for that specific customer segment throughout the buying process, depending on which part of the buying process they are in. And there we utilize paid social. Google Ads is pretty big for us in terms of...
retargeting.
Yeah, retargeting, that's a tricky one. It has produced results in some cases previously. However, when it depends on the network, how accurate you can be regarding the retargeting, that are you actually spending budget on the companies that are good fits for you, or are you able to, you know, specify it accurately enough for that purpose? Because also you can spend tons of money on retargeting for random visitors just looking for information out of pure interest.
Yeah, yeah, but yeah. And in B2B, the segments are quickly so small that you cannot target them anymore.
Exactly. So sometimes we do this a bit of manual side of retargeting as well, that whenever they get, we know that, you know, these customers have visited our website, have been interested about us, we are interested about them. Audiences are not big enough to do the actual automated retargeting. Perhaps we launch a LinkedIn campaign only for their directors.
Yeah. So basically, the one thing that I'm seeing a lot is that companies are not willing to spend money on or are reluctant to invest into content marketing, especially search-based, because they think that the rewards are so far away, and they are difficult to estimate, and the search volumes are not there. It's difficult to see that, okay, there are 300 searches globally for this keyword happening, and so forth. So I assume that there isn't too much search traffic either in your segment as well. So how did you
I don't have the exact numbers, but overall, since day one, SEO has been one of our, you know, long-term strategies when it comes to marketing. We want to be the kings of the hill when it comes to our industry in SEO. In some markets, we are actually doing that quite nicely right now. In some markets, there's much more competition, and then we need to boost our game and make sure that that happens eventually. But I think if going back to what you mentioned earlier, that a lot of times when people, you know, jump into the, especially startups, realize that we have a product that should be found easily from Google, their idea of the investment is that I'm gonna hire one young person who's really visible in social media, and they can probably do this overnight, and we're gonna be number one in Google. Mm-hmm. I've also been in a company where I was approached by a C-level member saying that they know a guy who can get us to be number one in Google. And some people actually still believe that that can be doable by one person overnight. It is actually much more than that.
What's the reality?
Reality is that it's a long-term strategy, and you build the foundation, and it's sort of playing the game of SEO is sort of like if you know the castle that they're, or I don't know if it's a temple or what's the right word, church that they're building in Barcelona.
Yeah.
They've been building it for I don't know how many years, but it's still, I think if now there's at least a date when it's going to be ready.
Yeah, a couple of hundred years, I think.
And it's playing the game of SEO, especially in several different markets, it's kind of like that.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, even if you're not number one in that market, but you're constantly building your way through there, then it's going to be a cumulative process in terms of what you actually get out of it. And I think overall, it's something that you need to be sort of on top of things, because Google's algorithm changes. The old SEO tricks and hacks are no longer relevant. Now we see AI coming up. That's definitely going to have an impact on the way that Google ranks pages and so forth. So it's something that you need to be on top of things technologically as well. You need to understand and try to understand as best as you can your ideal customer, what could be the things that they are looking for. Also do a bit of research on how that actually works. But at the end of the day, Google wants good content to be on top of the listing. You can go as deep technologically as you want to, but if you actually release a good piece of content that outside external sources refer to that content, that's going to get you gradually higher and higher up on that billboard. And also, some things that people don't always necessarily, especially if they have only been doing SEO for a short period of time, is that when you actually target the high intent long tail keywords, that's where the purchase decision lies.
Yeah.
And then having the logic that, you know, if you can actually win the game on those keywords with your best performing bottom of the funnel type of content, you're actually probably looking for quicker wins than what you would otherwise get from playing the SEO game.
Yeah, that... talking about targeting, where should you target the funnel? Of course, you should target, if possible, the bottom end.
Yeah.
Because the farther you go, the longer you need to educate them.
That is true.
And the more you will lose during the journey. So if there are enough customers, you don't need many, actually, because such a high percentage will convert.
Right.
That's, again, something to, if you start to build the funnel, you probably, it's a good idea to start quite close to the product.
Yeah.
And then
further. And also, if thinking about an individual piece of content, if you have, you know, limited resources and you can produce four pieces of content in 2024, make sure that all of those are case studies from existing customers.
Yeah.
Easily the best performing piece of content and most usable in sales, marketing, advertisement, you name it.
But again, you probably have some angle how to do those, because what I'm seeing is that oftentimes you're producing case studies that are quite the same.
Yeah.
Meaning that there's no different angle.
Right.
Like if you talk with a journalist, they never do interviews with the same format. They always have an angle and then use a format.
Right. Right. Yeah, I think overall the main thing, if you think about case studies, at least in my ideal thinking, we would have few relevant case studies for each segment and each territory that we're in. Because, like you mentioned, a journalist would not sort of write the same piece or same type of piece over and over again. But what is the relevance for a real estate player for this case study that was actually about the gas station?
Yeah, that's one thing. That's sort of for example, for real estate, you cannot do all the case studies for that in the same format.
Right.
So you kind of have, at least headline level, you need to select the angle.
Yeah.
Okay. For this case, we'll need to talk about the business side of things. For this, we need to discuss about the problems of installing it or whatever it might be.
Right.
So
yeah.
Kind of have for different objections or different.
Yes, and also when it comes to basic sales methodology, MEDIC, when you think about it, metrics is there one of the really highlighted keywords. And at the end of the day, when you think about like how does the prospective customer measure success?
Yeah.
And the better you can actually address that in terms of numbers, data, the story itself in the case studies, the better impact it's going to have on the prospective customer.
Yeah. But getting back to the SEO thing, as we're talking about, let's say, your story here, how long did it take to see actual results? You're still fighting the battle in number of different markets, different languages, and obviously you were also having problems of targeting the right audience, because in either judging there's a ton of consumers searching that topic, there are journalists searching that topic, there are EV owners searching the topics, and apartment buildings, which are not necessarily your business, are also searching the topic.
Yep.
So there's a lot of, let's say, non-customers also doing the search. So how did you find the keywords that are relevant just for you?
Well, I think there are a lot of tools that help you to do that. And then by testing, you kind of start to understand if there are patterns, if you keep an eye on, what type of conversions we are getting and where they are coming from in terms of that. I think a good example is that for a long time, we saw that based on data, our by far best performing piece of content was an ebook called How to Build a Business from EV Charging. Then a couple of years later, when we revisited the topic, we had been promoting that content on, different pop-ups, different conversion points throughout the website, because we saw that it's actually performing well. People like to download it. And then when we actually started to analyze the discussions that the SDRs have had with the, especially in UK more than anywhere else, that what they had, what type of discussions they had with the prospective customers after that conversion, they were, for a large part, they were people that were thinking about building a startup around EV charging.
Okay, so they were non-customers.
So they were actually someone that if things go well for them, they could be our customer in a couple of years. But at the moment, not relevant, waste of time, waste of money. So these type of things you actually just learn along the way, and you need to be on top of your own metrics that you're not becoming blind to the fact that like, hey, this ebook is being downloaded, more than any other. That's great, but actually go a bit deeper and analyze the actual impact on the cases that land into your pipeline. And what are the, common nominators in these cases that actually derive from this specific ebook? Maybe it's a certain vertical, maybe it's a certain problem that you're looking for. And also one of the V2G was a really, really hot topic. It still is, but a couple of years ago, it was something that the whole industry was talking about. And we created a lot of SEO-friendly material for that, reached number one in Google in several countries. But the problem with that is also that no one actually knows, when it comes to the customers, that what you do with V2G still today. It's something vehicle to grid is which shortened from basically the ideology that while your car is plugged to the EV charger, the power can go both ways. So your car can be used as a battery. And that was obviously something that was super interesting. But nowadays, if we look at the conversions that we get from there, usually the type of conversions we get is that either we are looking to, you know, launch a project around this in 2025 or something. It's something more of a research experiment type of project. Or it's individual people that actually want to build like a smart electric system into their own homes.
Yeah. And again, it's a trend. Trends are good to surf from.
Right.
But they might not actually serve the business, at least on the short term.
Right. Right. And that's also, you know, you need to, SEO cannot be a separate game you play. Yeah. It actually needs to be the part of whatever you are doing in sales and marketing, hopefully jointly. SEO is one of the tools that you use to serve the same group of customers that you would otherwise also want in your funnel.
Yeah, and they, let's say, you have to measure the quality of the leads by the sales.
Yes.
And in some cases, you might be getting a ton of not so quality leads, but there might be some gold nuggets within that volume. And in some cases, you get quite a good quality leads only from that ebook or whatever it might be. So again, the percentage doesn't matter, but the end result, how many nuggets did you get out of it?
Exactly. That's very, very, very correct. And that also comes back to the overall ideology that whenever you have a sales and marketing functions, if you want them to work together, put the same KPIs, have the same goals that are shared in order to drive towards those same results. Because then it's very easy to agree on the definition that what is a good lead, what is actually the end result that we are trying to do with this specific campaign or, you know, advertisement campaign or even a physical event.
Yeah. What about the other ways to, let's say, drive traffic?
Well, obviously, I already mentioned that Google Ads is one of the bigger ways for us. But something that has
keyword ads or display
keyword, keyword,
obviously,
yeah.
And that's kind of a way to jump the line when you are not performing SEO wise.
Exactly, that's what we do in new markets, or you know, younger markets for us that we haven't had someone focusing on the content marketing side for long. Then obviously, we try to sort of jump the line a little bit in order to be visible, be somewhere visible on Google. And it's actually quite nicely working operation in a way that you drive towards the same goal, whether it's SEM or SEO, but then it's just the better you are at SEO, the less money you need to spend on the ad side.
Yeah, yeah. What about the other paid?
Well, basically, we're utilizing... Well, I already mentioned the SEO, SEM. We're doing also some promotion on the social channels, but personally, I would really like us to go more into the motion that we use money for new customer acquisition only when we already have enough data that we know that these are specific customers that we want and should be going after.
Okay.
What we're utilizing for that is that we have a built-in ICP scoring system in our CRM that we use external data, compare our existing sales data, and every time a new company comes in, it gets a scoring. So at least even if we don't know the company, by data we can actually identify that if this is, you know, have we been successful in sales with the similar type of companies previously.
Yeah.
So that also gives you a sort of, even if you don't know the company, but the data actually says that, you know, this might be a good idea, this might not be a good idea. At least you have some criteria to work upon in that sense.
Yeah. Do you do any, let's say, account-based marketing kind of operation?
Yes, we do. And also that is, let's say that depends on the definition of ABM as always. That's one of the acronyms that the whole marketing world fights about.
Sounds much fancier than it is.
Right, right. Because a lot of times what you're talking about is that you are actually just doing targeted marketing for specific companies. There might be a few of them. There might be some tens of them or hundred of them,
yeah,
depending. But yes, especially what we've been doing that to some extent for a couple of years. And now I think we are moving more towards the motion that we are going to pick very selected strategic customers and plan it a bit more long term than we have done previously.
Yeah.
Because something that I've also learned is that I talked with a sales director from I think it was SAP or Workday back in the day, and I think the discussion with him was brilliant because he explained it to me that, you know, his experiences of ABM is that it works really well in their business, but the salesperson needs to have the desire to get ABM to help him. It needs to be a process that is led by the salesperson, because at the end of the day, they are the ones who know the strategy on how are we going to win this account, what are the value props that we are actually going to go with, what are the pains that we want to address. And if that message is not constant, despite what the touch point the customer has with you, then the whole thing falls apart. And unfortunately, I've been part of many ABM campaigns that start when we have already sent out an offer, and then for the next couple of weeks we want to, you know, have the maximum exposure. Okay, it's better than nothing,
yeah,
that's okay. But then when this comes back to the, like, is that actually ABM that we were doing, or was it just desperate targeted marketing?
But again, you mentioned one important point, that the marketing and sales, the handover.
Yeah.
Or I wouldn't even call it a handover, because it's not a handover in a way that marketing stops there.
Right, right.
Rather that the role stops. First it's marketing guided operation, and then it's sales guided, but the marketing will continue after that. And also the sales can handle back the guidance to the marketing.
Right.
So depending on how the case is going on. And quite typical is that marketing is providing leads and sales is dropping them on the floor. And
Classic. And that also comes that, you know, back to what I mentioned earlier, the number one thing to fix is the process. And that's, if you have a process in place but the leads are dropping on the floor, then, you know, either there's a breakdown in communication, or you have not agreed to the definitions of what are we actually doing, what is the, you know, how does the process go step by step, what are the roles, sort of internal SLAs.
And not just the process, also the messaging needs to be, the narrative needs to go through the sales.
Yes.
Without any seams.
Right.
Because otherwise there's a disconnect.
Right.
And the sales thinks that, okay, this is, I cannot continue from this angle.
Right.
Or I don't want to continue from this angle. Right.
That is very true, and that also comes down to whether you have an SDR team or not. That's also something that you really need to consider and think about, that, you know, should it be operating in a way that, for example, SDR takes the first meeting, then documents that, hands it over to the sales executive, and they take it forward the best they see, or maybe do you have a joint second meeting where actually you have both parties present, and then also there's a chance for both parties to learn as well, give feedback.
Yeah. What other operations you mentioned, events?
Yeah, well, let's say that back in the day when I joined the company, I did a math that how much did one contact in our CRM from events cost us the previous year. Take a guess.
1,000?
We're not talking about lead, we're talking about a contact.
Okay.
1,000 is your guess.
Yeah.
Roughly 1,900. That was the number that we had back in the day. And I think that's also, if I would be brutally honest, the trend that I'm seeing when setting up a sales organization is that the more you are worried about the competition and put your focus in there, And the more you're desperate to go to random sales events in terms of leads, the more immature is your sales organization and the process itself.
Yeah.
At least the trend that we're seeing internally is that whenever the sales teams get their shit together, they have processes in place, things are up and running, then the events that they want to go to are very selective and strategic ones instead of just, you know, going to a random event and hoping for miracles.
And probably they are doing it year after year, so kind of you build up the presence.
Yes,
and
yes,
not just
exactly.
going there and not knowing how to place yourself in that event and how to get the audience and so forth.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, that's definitely. And also, I would argue that whenever going to an event, you should approach it exactly the same way as you approach any sales or marketing campaign, that you have a clear agreed goal in mind. Are we here to build brand presence? Are we here to meet existing customers and build the relationships there? Or are we actually hunting for new leads?
Yeah.
And then you measure the success depending on those metrics as well. And in my mind, there should be no difference whether it's a physical event or a webinar or whatever type of activity you're doing.
Of course,
rules apply.
Of course, in the, if it's self-organized webinar or so forth, you are driving the traffic there.
Right.
Whereas if you go to a trade show, you kind of pay to get access to the traffic that's happening.
Right, but I think that the classic example is that a lot of times what I mentioned about this maturity level of the sales teams, the trend that I saw in many countries is that when the sales team doesn't really have a process and cadences and way of working in place that it would be structured, a lot of times you saw them participating in EV charging events.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. I mean, yeah, relevant industry players were there. Who are we talking with? Our competitors and other industry players.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't we rather go to an event where our customers are?
Yeah. Like hotel events.
Exactly,
or
exactly. Or, you know, construction companies, real estate, gas stations.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, some of your people needs to go to the eBay events.
Right.
So always, but they are not necessarily for
yeah, exactly, exactly. Yeah. And then also, this comes back to the fact that you need to know, like, why are you there? What is the goal of you being there? What are the things that you want to be measured upon if you actually made the trip there?
We are kind of covered the things, not necessarily in any particular order, but kind of cover the ground. But what are the inspiration sources? How do you keep how you improve your craft?
Well, I read quite a lot, usually from online sources to the things that I run into. I don't have specific people or persons that I would follow. And I also really, really like to try to widen the spectrum of my thinking in a way that, for example, the reason that I joined Virta was that I wanted to be more involved in sales. Yeah. I wanted to be, you know, not purely on the marketing side, I wanted to be more on the sales side and learn from that. But I would say that the inspiration sources, a lot of times when you see companies doing something that really opens up your eyes in ways of like, okay, they have actually built this and made it to something that works. To me, that is much more inspirational than, you know, a specific TED talk or a sales coach or a marketing coach that LinkedIn is full of. And especially with a lot of people preaching other people on how to do things, and also I have been one of them myself when I was working as a consultant, a lot of times I faced the situation that they may have not walk the walk themselves.
Yeah, and then, and of course, we have two kinds of gurus. We have those who tell that, okay, you should do this.
Right.
And this is a one-size-fits-all kind of approach.
Right.
And then we have those consultants, it depends.
Yeah.
Every answer begins from, it depends.
Right.
And after half an hour, you still don't know what they are going to suggest.
Right.
So try to navigate those.
Yeah, but actually, now that you asked about inspirations, I think one of the most influential books, at least for my thinking, what I have read and what I think, like, even though it talks about OKR methodology, but I think there was a lot of other good things when you think about the especially in the digital marketing and sales world, how you need to kind of like set the goals that go to the same direction, and then the process kind of like finds its way there automatically. Okay. And I'm talking about measure what matters.
Okay.
And, yeah. And I think that has had a big impact on the way of my thinking and the way that I want to be running my teams too. Because I really like the book itself, and the methodology itself obviously works. But then I think it has a, it's not only the methodology, but it's also, you know, we are in a competitive environment, always operating with limited resources. We need to always understand internally, what are we trying to do? What is the number that's going to change if we take part in this project? What are we actually trying to achieve by taking part in this event?
Yeah.
And unless those goals are aligned across the teams that are part of the whole exercise, then sooner or later, you're going to go to a wrong direction there.
Yeah.
So I think that has a, you know, even though it talks about the specific methodology, but I think there's a lot that can be applied into running a team, being a team leader, talking with the individuals, and also the digital and technological processes as well.
I have that book. I haven't read it yet. I've had to move it on top of the...
You probably should.
top of the list. One note here is that thinking when you're talking about gurus and marketing inspirational sources and kind of there are two different approaches. You, as an agency player like you used to be, you need to be very good on the craft itself.
Right.
But as a director, you need to be good on leading the process. You don't need to be that good on the actual
detail
marketing
stuff. Right, right.
I mean, your challenges are probably much more leading problems.
Yeah.
How do you get the organization do the things that you want them to do? Whereas in agency business, you are advising the customer, and the customer is not doing what you're advising.
Right. So you're.
But you kind of have a leadership problem, but you don't have.
Right.
It.
Right. Yeah. I think overall, personally, I think I'm very hands-on when it comes to stuff. I help people build dashboards. I dig into the different technological stuff and try to find ways, because I think deep down I'm very lazy and I love to automate stuff.
Yeah.
And then if I can help someone else's daily work, that I automated something for them, makes me feel good. And I think this is overall something that even though I have a couple of teams that are reporting to me, but I don't want to lose that part of my job where I can actually spend a few hours per week that I dig into something, maybe learn something new, and then I'm able to make someone else's life a little bit easier or our process more fluent, or maybe get two different pieces of software to talk together, and all of a sudden we have a better view of the customer itself. So I think personally, I luckily have not lost the whole hands-on part of things, and not the little geek in me is still quite happy about it. And I think that really helps, that even though I might not be, you know, listening to the SDR sales calls on a daily basis, like what they actually discuss about, but when I look at the overall process, how things are moving, I can quite easily identify from data if some stuff is not happening that should be happening, and then obviously go from there and discuss those things, what may be the reasons behind it. And oftentimes what is a big part of my work as well is to sort of make sure that we run the same process in each geo as we speak. And that's also something that it's not only me leading my team, it's actually me leading sideways our geo directors.
Yeah.
And also the more responsibility you get in the company, the more the internal sales of different things becomes actually a daily part of your job.
Like I said, a ton of your work is actually leading nowadays, whereas in agency business, was much more in the doing side.
Yeah, that is true. And also, obviously, you know, in a growth company, the challenges are endless.
We often
discuss about it with a lot of colleagues that were always in the middle of a constant chaos, and that actually is true when you are in a company that grows very fast. Sometimes the, you know, we start steering the ship this way, and the next week we're actually going to the opposite direction, and you just need to be able to deal with it and not just completely go crazy when things like that happen. And I think also a lot of the challenges that comes from the leadership aspects, if you think about throughout the past few years, I think at the very core of it, you cannot emphasize the importance of recruiting the right people enough. And that always is it's not an easy matter, and it can be something that eventually, you know, it bites you back a couple of years after you actually have done the decision.
Yeah.
It doesn't go well. And then also, especially when you have the pressure of the high growth, and then all of a sudden there might be a lot of headcount growth as well, then how do you actually find the balance between, you know, the recruitment side of things, because you do need to be involved in it to actually make sure that things go the way they should, but then also that always comes on top of everything else that your daily calendar is already filled with.
Yeah, and on those times of the day and where you not necessarily want them.
Yeah.
Because the recruiting happens
right
in unplannable,
right,
say,
right, exactly,
schedule.
Exactly. But I think, like, overall, when you think about the very core of the leadership, at least I believe that what people want from their leader is structure and direction.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, if you can provide those things, and then obviously when you work in a, that you have a lot of people above you and you have some teams that actually report to you, you're always going to be a little bit caught in between. And that requires internal sales. Sometimes they go upwards, sometimes they go downwards. But at the end of the day, if you can provide, you know, clarity, structure, and direction to your team, that's what usually is a very good way to motivate people as well.
You mentioned one trait, that you are lazy, and laziness is often considered as a bad trait.
Right.
Although Bill Gates has been quoted saying that he prefers to hire lazy people because they find solutions.
Right.
They automate stuff.
Yeah.
And because they are lazy. And I prefer to think the same. Me also being lazy. If you're not lazy, you are willing to do ton of stuff day after day after day.
Right.
Whereas if you're lazy, you try to find ways to automate. You try to find ways to create processes.
Right.
You try to find ways to code systems or whatever to do.
Right.
You're much more innovative in that sense.
I fully agree. And oftentimes what I witness is that people are too busy with their daily tasks to take one step back and focus on the more important matters.
Yeah.
And you know, people are too busy to spend one day of automating a task that they spend 4 hours per day to do.
Yeah. So let's try to close this up. For our young listeners who are thinking of their career choices, what advices would you give to yourself if you're starting as a 20-year-old self again? Would you choose the craft again, or would you make different choices regarding what kind of companies you would like to work with in the beginning?
I think overall, if I think about my sort of career path so far, and I think about 20-year-old myself, I think one of the most important skills in today's work environment is to be able to learn new things quickly and adapt quickly, because things are changing on a rapid pace. You know, my job did not exist 15 years ago.
Yeah.
And if I think about the 20-year-old myself, I would probably give a tip that I should be very focused on what is it that I actually want to do as a job instead of what is it that I actually want to study. Because to me, at least, those seem to be two little bit of a different things.
Yeah,
is fun to study might lead to a profession that is not actually something that tickles your brains the same way. But if I would think about, like, from the general perspective, I would really, really look into looking for different type of training opportunities, what actually it is that, you know, what gives you the thrive that in the morning when you get out of bed, what makes you get out of bed, what is it, the thing that actually, you know, you get this little tickling sensation that now we're actually doing something that matters to me as well. And I would spend some time thinking about it, and then also not necessarily care that much about the salary at that point, because it's much, much more valuable to understand what is it that you want to do at that point when you actually enter the job market and are looking for an actual job, your first job that you want to do. I had no clue. I probably had no clue still when I was 27.
And you would select the same route again? Kind of, or at least same target?
Yeah, hard to say. It was kind of, first I studied media and communications, and then a lot of people from there were actually working either as researchers or journalists.
Yeah.
Then from there I went to work as I think I was like a communications manager or a communication specialist, which was my first actual job that was somehow related to communications or marketing. I come back from my summer holiday and we have this new cards on our table, and all of a sudden it says marketing. So I was like, ah, okay, hint taken. So that was the switch from there. Then it kind of naturally evolved on my side more towards the digital side of things, because that was what I was more interested about, and also that seemed much, much more relevant and effective at that time. And then from there it kind of like has been evolving naturally, and then nowadays much more towards sales. So I don't know if that can be, I don't know if that is a traditional path or what type of path it is, has worked for me, but there has been no one really guiding the way, and for some people that could be an important thing as well.
I would categorize this as a growth wizardy. I mean, what I'm meaning is that it doesn't matter what the actual skill sets are, whether you're more sales focused or you're more, let's say, marketing focused or content focused or paid ad focused or whatever,
right.
But you need to be kind of generalist. And anyway, the big opportunity for these kind of growth wizards comes from taking startups to the world. These kind of positions didn't exist 10 years ago,
right,
because we didn't have those companies.
And
nowadays people like you are making their careers. What I haven't seen much in Finland is that we have those guys as a founder team members making unicorns.
Right.
But after a while, we tend to see those happening in different other markets, where we kind of see that, okay, the guys who in Silicon Valley have been in a couple of startups in growth roles are now co-founders of, or being recruited as a first five employee, with big stock options and big slices of the companies. In the beginning, they are making millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions.
Right.
And think about, for example, the whole PayPal mafia. What's happening nowadays?
Right.
It kind of, everybody is somewhere.
Yeah.
Someone founded LinkedIn, and the other founded Tesla, and so forth.
Yeah. Makes total sense. And I think overall, one of the things that it's not necessarily something that I would say to 20-year-old myself or to any 20-year-old, but what I'd like to say to a lot of marketers is that you're going to be incredibly more valuable if you study sales. Try to understand the sales process, how it actually works, and get as close to it as possible, you know, take part in customer meetings. And I think that's still sort of the distinction that I see, not only coming from the companies themselves, but actually marketers themselves.
Not necessarily selecting sales as a career.
Right.
Because sales career is still, you can do that much sales yourself.
Right.
and your values based on how much sales you can make.
Right.
But if you are a growth wizard,
yeah, you need to understand.
You can raise a company from 1 million to 100 million, and 100 million to billion, and right. so forth. Then you're a rainmaker.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Obviously, your value to the team is totally different.
Right.
But then you're a founder-level guy,
right.
and not someone who is going to be hired
from
outside. But you need several positions to graduate to there,
yeah.
unless you get really lucky and hang up with the guys in the startup community and join a startup as a 20-year-old yourself, and you make it big, and everybody considers you as a rainmaker, even though you didn't know what you were doing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, that happens too, and good for them. But yeah, I think like overall, like when you mentioned the word growth, I think a lot of times, especially not necessarily that much anymore, but if we go a few years back, I think a lot of companies in Finland were thinking growth as something that if we hire just one marketer and we do a great job in recruitment, they're going to turn things overnight to something else, and all of a sudden we're going to be global, and everyone's going to be talking about it instead of thinking it as a long-term investment.
And the problem with that approach is that when you're selecting a marketer or a marketing agency, if you're selecting a marketer, you're basically selecting someone who is probably having a, say, old skill set.
Right.
A quite limited skill set, mostly on the management side of things, rather than on a creative or growth side of things. And if you're hiring an agency, you're probably hiring someone who is specialist in one or two things.
Right.
Meaning that you are not actually... When you're selecting an agency, you are actually selecting your strategy.
Right.
But you didn't make that choice.
Right, right.
And that's the problem.
Yeah, yeah, that is true. And overall, like the idea of having a clear strategy and then having your marketing sort of, you know, having obviously your marketing strategy aligned to that, but considering the whole company as an sort of like the, you know, growth engine, everything is interlinked, and these different departments need to work with one another in order for the whole equation to work. And I think that is something that, especially in Finland, we are still way, way behind.
Yeah. This is a good place to start, end this all. And to summarize it, this kind of a, let's say, the growth wizard is multi-talent. Talent show or a sport. You need to be good on so many things.
Yeah.
It's not SEO. It's not paid. It's not sales. It's everything. It's messaging. It's
yeah. I think if I would speak from my own perspective, or you know, from what I've seen during the past few years, it's not that you come up with some very creative, you know, groundbreaking idea. It's much more having the structure to do the long-term work and put pieces together, find what works for you, and then optimize from there. That has been our approach. When in doubt, simplify.
Yeah.
And that really has been the, you know, having the structure in place that we actually can prove that works, then build upon that foundation piece by piece, test something new, see if it works. If it does, good, keep it in the portfolio. If it doesn't, well, then do something else. But we haven't ever really expected anything to happen overnight. Always when we hire a new marketer in some geos, I talk with the geo leader and I make sure that they understand that you're not going to see a single difference in results within the first 6 months. Don't expect that. That's not going to happen. Then we see actually 12 months from now that we are starting to rank better in Google. Our website might be more to the local tone that what you have been asking for the past couple of years, and then we're actually gonna see, you know, a stable growth from there. And that's why we are hiring this marketing person here. We're not trying to hire someone who's gonna turn over things overnight, because that just doesn't happen.
Yeah, those creative things are obviously interesting to read from Ogilvy's books or whatever it might be, or hear the ad agency stories,
right.
But this seldom.
Yeah.
that kind of stuff. Yeah. A ton of leadership management
right.
kind of things.
Right, tying processes together, making sure that everything's aligned towards the same goal. And quite basic stuff.
System, building processes, building systems.
Right.
Problem solving.
Yeah.
And handling ton of different kind of sports in it. So you kind of need to know everything, at least in a superficial level. Like they said in growth hacking, you need to know the basics of almost everything,
right.
and then you are really good on something.
Yeah, yeah, and also I think that when you think about, you know, the whole spectrum of things, besides that. Like, for example, we are doing a variety of different things around content, but at the end of the day, it very much comes down to that the better you know your customer, or at least want to know your customer,
yeah.
the better your direction is going to be.
That's the one who understands what the customer wants, content-wise, is usually the winner.
Yeah.
In
exactly.
almost all of the things.
Exactly.
Whether you are paid ad or SEO or whatever.
Right, and then when you actually are able to identify those patterns that, okay, we have this set of customer that is actually trying to solve this problem
yeah.
through us, maybe we should address that problem in the content.
How do we educate them?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Thank you, Samuli. And you can be followed in LinkedIn?
Yeah, I'm at least can be found on Twitter, LinkedIn, Instagram, those channels at least. So
yeah.
not going to be like a treasure hunt to find me from there, so feel free to follow.
All right. Thank you, Samuli. This was an absolute pleasure. I have at least learned a lot. I hope
Thank you so much.
Listeners also learned a lot. And I hope that we hear a ton of other $100 million Finnish startup stories in coming years. Unfortunately, we don't have too many of those in the same caliber, most of the
fingers crossed there would be more to come in the future.
Yeah. Thank you for all the listeners, and until next time, bye-bye.
Thank you very much.